Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Liberty Coin Service, now open with a new location in Frandor, offering gold buying and coin collecting services in one combined location for more than 40 years. LibertyCoinService.com.
Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We present the people and the topics making the heart of Mid-Michigan beat every weekday morning at 9 o'clock and at 6 p.m. on WKAR-FM and at noon on AM 870 WKAR. And you can get in touch for any reason at any time at currentstate@wkar.org. There's been significant movement at the state capitol regarding medical marijuana quite recently. Late last week, State Rep Mike Calton of Nashville, just west of Lansing, announced he'll introduce a bill that would allow businesses to dispense cannabis. Now, just days before that, the Michigan Supreme Court ruled the state's pot law does not allow so-called dispensaries. Here is the Republican rep just last Thursday explaining a key reason for his new proposal.
The problem is there's 126,000 patients in Michigan right now, and only one in three has a caregiver. So the Supreme Court ruling by taking out the dispensaries, and I could see it wasn't in the law, but either it leaves patients without caregivers either to go underground or to go without.
And Current State welcomes two guests to respond to this measure. The Honorable Stuart Dunnings Jr. is the Ingham County prosecutor. He's one of many legal officials and police who have been frustrated by what many people say are vagaries of Michigan's medical marijuana law. And Robin Schneider is a Lansing resident and a legislative liaison for the National Patients' Rights Association. Mr. Dunnings, welcome.
Good morning, Mark.
Robin.
Good morning. Good morning, both of you.
If at any point the host gets anything wrong here, feel free to jump in, because this is a pretty complicated landscape. Let's back up to the state Supreme Court ruling, first of all. And Prosecutor Dunnings, what's your interpretation of what the state Supreme Court said? What's the heart of what they said here about 10 days or so ago when they said that dispensaries cannot exist in Michigan?
Well, that's right. They said that dispensaries are a nuisance. That means they can be banned by injunctive relief under the nuisance law.
They can, or
they can.
Will.
They're a nuisance. They are a nuisance. They are the activities that are going on in dispensaries are not exempt under the Michigan medical marijuana law.
Okay. And Robin Schneider, what's your interpretation of the state Supreme Court's ruling?
Well, in my opinion, they didn't actually define what a dispensary is in the ruling. What they did was they looked at a particular case coined as the McQueen case, and they said, this business, the transfers that were happening within this business are not protected by the act. Therefore, that business or anybody operating by their model could be considered a public nuisance. I know the Attorney General had sent out memos and press releases, declaring victory that the Supreme Court had said dispensaries are illegal. Actually, there's nowhere in the ruling where they actually say that dispensaries are illegal. So that was an incorrect response. I think that if there are medical marijuana businesses that are there that are not doing those transfers that have been deemed illegal, it's quite possible that they aren't breaking the law, but it depends from place to place what type of transfers are happening within those facilities.
Stuart Dunnings, is it clear to you what a dispensary does exactly? I mean, has been so much confusion over what this single word means for so long.
The only thing that is allowed is a caregiver to patient transfer. They said that patient to patient transfers cannot occur.
So can a caregiver to patient transfer happen in a dispensary?
Sure, but that caregiver can only dispense to his five patients. He cannot dispense to anybody else's patients.
Okay.
So I don't know. You can have a store where you can only sell to five people. so that's
Well, caregivers could also do business at a location with their patients, and that could be a dispensary, correct? Are we all agreed on that?
Well, you could have a group of caregivers each supplying to their own particular patients, but then each of their marijuana will have to be in its own separate enclosed secure area.
Okay. Is that what's called for in Representative Calton's measure, Robin?
No, Representative Calton's measure, which is actually, I believe, will be formally read in tomorrow, and that's House Bill 4251, 4257, I believe. that measure will make dispensaries legal, and we call them provisioning centers is the term that will be used for those. And the idea is that a patient who doesn't have a caregiver, as Rep. Calton just said in the last clip there, one in three patients do not have a caregiver and do not have access to medical marijuana, and they might not be able to grow it for themselves. So it's time for the legislature to act and say, you know, this is what a dispensary is. This is who's allowed to operate them. You know, I think the bill puts restrictions on felons owning them. It puts into place things that stop redistribution, sets quantity limitations, and really regulates it. But the thing that I think is best about the upcoming legislation is that it allows for a local option. So say Lansing or Ann Arbor would like to have provisioning centers, that they can say, okay, you can have them. This is how we're going to zone them. They've got to be 1,000 feet from a school, and we only want five. That's something that the municipalities will be able to tailor to their own community, where other areas might say, you know, we don't want them at all. And that's fine. If they don't have a place for them in their community, then that's something that we don't feel should be pushed on communities that don't want them. But we do want to know that patients have safe locations that are secure to go access their marijuana, not just smokable marijuana. Smokable marijuana, in my opinion, is not the healthiest form of ingestion. They may want forms that are edible. They may want non-psychoactive forms of cannabis. So we want to make sure that they're able to get a hold of the, you know, best of the medicine.
Stuart Dunnings, have you read through Representative Calton's proposed measure?
Well, his bill hasn't been introduced yet. It's not available. I tried to find it on the Internet Friday, and it's not there. However, he did introduce a bill last year, and I think this bill probably will be somewhat similar. And in the bill, he allows for three different kind of facilities. One is the provisioning center, where people would actually go to get their product. One is a safety compliance facility, which is a place that's used to test the marijuana, and a secure cultivation facility where marijuana could be grown.
Okay, Robin, you wanted to respond to
I
that.
I do. I actually have a copy here for you, but you're not here, sir, so I can't give it to you. But that's correct. It is similar. The cultivation facilities were removed from the bill, though, I think in part to make certain people happy that, you know, weren't happy that was in there. So that's one of the bigger differences.
Well, what's at the crux of the proposal, and the issue appears all along to have been access, mm-hmm. clarifying how access would work for certified patients and caregivers. Sure. How do card-holding patients get marijuana now in Lansing?
They can, you know, find a caregiver if they're lucky. The problem is that I hear over and over again from patients, my caregiver didn't show up. My caregiver didn't call me back. You know, they said that the crop died. And in my opinion, a good caregiver, regardless of what happens with their crop, will make sure that they acquire that medicine for their patient. That's not always the case. And so, I mean, I've had experience, I think I shared with you, I've lost several friends in the last year to cancer, AIDS, MS, and it's been tough watching this. I get very attached to these people, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're dying. But one of my dear friends, Greg, and he actually was an MSU alumni, and he was the president of student housing here on campus. He, you know, he had a tracheotomy and a feeding tube, and he calls me and he says, you know, I need help, and I need help right away. And so here we are looking for liquid form of THC to put through his feeding tube, and, you know, we go all over Lansing. We can't find it anywhere. All we can find is smokable marijuana. So we ended up driving clear to Ann Arbor, an hour and a half away, before he finally found that liquid, you know, marijuana to put into his feeding tube. But it was, to me, it was like, this shouldn't have been so difficult to do this, and everybody should have, you know, access to those alternative forms. I mean, you can go anywhere. You can go into any neighborhood and find a bag of marijuana. That's not what the sickest of the patients really need. Is that's not what they're looking for.
Stuart Dunnings, if Representative Calton's measure is based in large measure on the old one, with which you are familiar, do you feel, do you have the feeling that the new revised measure is likely a good one and one that you could live with?
Yeah, I've felt all along that under the current statute, dispensaries were illegal, but I've also realized that, you know, the law says to people, you may have this and use it if you're qualified, but it doesn't tell you how you're going to get it. I think that's been a major weakness in the law. Plus, the way the law is written, it's just a mess, and people growing it in their homes presents its own set of problems, both from, you know, providing electricity. People have been subject to having their homes burglarized because people know there's marijuana. So I think there should be dispensaries in some way, shape, or form if we're going to have this.
Yeah, do you like the local control options?
Oh, very much, yeah. That's one of the positives in the bill, is that it provides a lot of leeway for local municipalities to have them, not have them, and if they have them, to put restrictions and regulate them. So I think that's certainly a positive in the bill.
Well, as a reporter who covered this a number of times here not too awful long ago, I'm just delighted that it appears the word dispensary is no longer in the... Robin, is the word dispensary in Representative Calton's measure? Because that has created more confusion than I can believe.
Yeah, it's been renamed provisioning centers because dispensaries have kind of a negative connotation to them. But, you know, one point that I want to make is that, you know, I hear... some law enforcement officials saying, we don't want these pot shops, and we don't want... And I say, do you know what's happening when we don't have them? It's happening in our neighborhoods. It's happening, you know, at my neighbor's house. People are coming and buying marijuana in our neighborhoods, around our children. And as a parent, that's not what I think is safe. I think it's safe to get the distribution out of our neighborhoods and put it into a zoned location where law enforcement know what's happening, they can monitor and inspect the situation, and it's going to take all of those little transactions out of our neighborhoods and put them somewhere that is safer. And that's what I want to see happen, is some control and some regulation, and for them to actually think through what is the safest scenario for caregivers, patients, and the community at large.
I absolutely agree with that. But one thing everybody needs to keep in mind is that under federal law, this is still illegal. And there's nothing to prevent the Drug Enforcement Administration or any other federal authorities from coming in and arresting and seizing anybody and anything involved in this trade.
Well, President Obama, I think the Obama administration has made it pretty clear in recent years that they, you know, they don't expect to enforce that terribly strongly now that the president's been reelected. Would you anticipate a change on that front, Stuart Dunnings, for any reason?
I don't know. I think it will depend on the extent to which people that are allowed to do this are staying within the framework of the law, and those people that are going beyond it and using it to actually have a marijuana illegal operation, which is what we found for some of these people that were running dispensaries under the old law. They weren't just doing it strictly within the confines of the Medical Marijuana Act to the extent it was arguably legal, but they were using it as fronts for commercial dope selling operations, and those were taken down. So I think it's going to depend. If it's highly regulated, and if the federal government continues the way they are, perhaps it won't be problematic. But the federal government can change its mind at any time.
Robin?
I think what you're probably referring to is known as the Holder Memo, where they basically said that if the person is in clear and ambiguous compliance with the state law, that we won't use our resources to go after them. And
Eric Holder.
Yes, right. Correct. Okay. And, you know, the problem with that is when you have a law that there is nothing clear and ambiguous about it, it's really hard to fall within that definition. And that's why I'm relieved to see the legislature taking action and to provide the opportunity to be in clear and ambiguous compliance.
Stuart Dunnings, are you pleased the legislature has, you know, is addressing this?
Yeah, it's been long overdue.
Part of this issue, too, is as well as what do legal growers do with their excess? Does the bill address that, Robin?
It does.
Overages.
It does. And you know, technically, I think what would be thought should happen would be that it would be destroyed. But I think a caregiver who's put in that much time and effort into growing a plant that is difficult to work with as marijuana, it's not an easy process. I think they're going to have a really hard time destroying the fruits of their labor. And I think that there are scenarios now where, you know, the overages, you know, maybe they're going to other patients, but maybe they're slipping off into the black market. And that's another, you know, problem. And so this bill would say if you have extra medicine, you can take it to these provisioning centers where it'll be redistributed to patients who need it. And that's, you know, a much safer scenario than, you know, having it end up in our streets. And that's another thing in the bill. It curtails the redistribution because it only allows the patients and caregivers to take so much from any facility within a 10-day period.
That was one of the major flaws in the current law is that if you have a good harvest of the 12 plants you're allowed, you're going to be automatically over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is ridiculous. You harvest and you're going to automatically be over, and what happens to it? So I'm glad to see hopefully that'll be taken care of.
Stuart, do you expect any kind of word from the Attorney General's office regarding Representative Colton's bill?
Well, as a matter of fact, the Prosecutors Association's Legislative Committee has a meeting on either Wednesday or Thursday of this week, and I'm sure this will be a topic of conversation, and the Attorney General is a member of the Prosecutors Association, and I'm pretty sure his representative will be there.
How about that?
There was an article in the Detroit Free Press this morning where the Attorney General's representative said there's no need for further legislation, and you know, he has historically been against anything having to do medical or not. My opinion is that he is not going to be reasonable about this in the least bit.
Okay, we've got to leave it there. I wish we had more time. This has been a great discussion. Stuart Dunnings Jr. is the Ingham County Prosecutor, and Robin Schneider is a legislative liaison for the National Patients' Rights Association. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you've joined us here today. One of the highest points of a great basketball season is tomorrow night at the Breslin Center. It's number one Indiana against MSU, and as if the game were not enough, I'm under the impression Magic Johnson will join Dick Vitale to call the game on ESPN. I believe that's the first time that's ever happened. The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexrow joins Current State to talk about the big game. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark, and that's right. This will be Magic's first college broadcast. So Magic Johnson, Dick Vitale, and it also could be the first meeting between top five teams in the history of not just Breslin Center, but of, you know, East Lansing, Michigan State. Michigan State's been in eight such games, never at home, and we'll find out later today if the Spartans got into the top five.
How about that? That's exciting. Where is Michigan State right now on the heels of the Nebraska win?
Well, I think that game actually was very nervous for Tom Izzo. You know, he knew how much his team put into the Michigan game and how well it performed. He knew his team was very aware of tomorrow's game and the implications. So he was nervous. And Nebraska is a team that actually was very close here late in the game, almost beat Ohio State at home a couple weeks ago. And it is, you know, really was a very good crowd Saturday night. And of course, Nebraska really was right there, just down a point with about 15 minutes left. So he was worried about that one, genuinely. And I think relieved to get through it. They, you know, the Spartans obviously had a big run in the second half to kind of get some distance and then stayed that way. But, you know, I think this team sees that this is a kind of a championship game. Not that winning it will clinch a championship, but the winner of tomorrow's game definitely is in good shape, you know, with four games to go.
Some people believe the Spartans are peaking right now, which just adds to the intensity. Are you one of them?
Well, I don't know if they're peaking. I still think this team could be better if a lot of the players, you know, are continue to play the way they are now, and then Travis Trice comes back. I still think this team really could use Travis Trice and could be a better team. Now, Denzel Valentine has really found his stride, and that's been important for this team. You know, he's been very good in the last few games, but this is still a team with a short bench, especially on the perimeter. So I think it's playing its best basketball this season so far, but I still think that there's a little bit more distance to the ceiling.
One of Indiana's most important players, Victor Oladipo, apparently has an injury. It's relatively minor, as I understand. I heard Tom Izzo tell another broadcaster, who shall remain nameless, that he saw Oladipo on a stationary bike after his injury, and Tom expects Oladipo to be completely on board. Any thoughts on that?
Well, he did not play in the second half of Saturday's win over Purdue, and at first it looked like it might be serious, but he was on the bench joking around, and of course his teammates after the game said, oh yeah, he's totally fine. Now, Tom Crean, Indiana's head coach, was a little less optimistic publicly, saying, well, you know, we hope he'll play, but you never know what's going to happen the next 24, 36 hours. Tom Crean will be on the Big Ten teleconference here shortly, maybe give an update there. I expect him to play, but it's possible he could be somewhat affected by the ankle.
U of M over Penn State, any comment there?
Well, I was surprised. I can't say I was able to watch it live because the Omaha airport does not have the Big Ten network, but following along the score, and I was very surprised that it was, you know, tied at the half and so close for so long. I actually ended up watching some of the replay last night, but obviously Michigan not playing its best basketball at all. So the Wolverines, you know, got the win, survived. They're going to get some time off here to get themselves right, but I think that Tuesday loss still had a little bit of an effect on them.
And we'll wrap up with this question. What will you be watching most closely tomorrow night?
Well, just like last week's game, there are a lot of really interesting matchups in this one. And the first time around, Cody Zeller, Derek Nix did a great job on Cody Zeller. Adrian Payne had a big game. Oladipo was huge for Indiana. He had 21 points and 6 steals. But the big key in that game was that Keith Appling really was not a factor. 19 minutes, 3 points, fouled out. And Yogi Ferrell, Indiana's freshman, you know, drew a few fouls on him getting around him. So I'll be watching that most closely. Michigan State has to have Appling for the whole game. Can't afford for him to get into foul trouble. And it'll be very interesting to watch Appling and Ferrell go at it. And I expect Keith Appling certainly to have a much more impactful game tomorrow than he did the first time around.
Sole possession of first place in the Big Ten on the line tomorrow night. We'll be looking for you, Joe Rexrode. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot, Mark.
Coming up on Current State, stay close. We've got Detroit Free Press columnist and reporter Nancy Kaffer updating all of Detroit's economic woes. There's a lot happening there. And Michigan State University in Bangladesh. It's MSU 360. Learn all about it coming up on Current State. I'm Mark Bajor. Welcome back to Current State. I'm Mark Bajor. State officials and many in Southeast Michigan have been keeping a really close eye on financial reports coming out of Detroit. Yesterday's Free Press reported that an emergency financial report completed late on Friday suggests an emergency manager is inevitable. The report found the city's deficit continues to grow even after some degree of state oversight that's been going on for more than 10 months now. It's one of the biggest ongoing stories really in Michigan, and here to explain what's happening is Detroit Free Press reporter and columnist Nancy Kaffer. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Mark.
These stories are just like a bad dream that will not end. What did this latest report find?
Well, this is the second state-ordered financial review of Detroit's finances, as you know. The last one was more than a year ago and led to the development of a consent agreement where the state was going to have some input in Detroit's or the created a financial advisory board to okay some financial decisions that the city would make, gave the mayor the ability to do some sort of non-typical mayoral things. This second report, which had to be done because of the change in the emergency manager law, is apparently a reporter, Matt Helms, found, was told by sources who had seen familiar with the report, that it's showing that there's not a lot of progress being made. In fact, not much progress being made. That the city's financial situation is getting worse, not better, and that it seems unlikely that the traditional methods of government, i.e. mayor and city council, are going to be very hard-pressed, if at all, to sort of turn the tide.
Too little, too late?
Well, you know, this is the problem, is that Detroit has obviously a large, sort of very sprawling bureaucracy. They've cut just a whole thousands of employees in the last several years, so they really have, the city government really has downsized. But the biggest problem is the city's long-term liabilities, and that's debt, but that's also pension obligations and other post-employment benefits like retiree health care. These are the really big problems, because you can't cut your way out of that. Like, I think they're spending something like 35 to 42 cents of every general fund dollar on meeting debt and these other liabilities.
Yeah.
And that's not a really good situation. I mean, if you're, you know, think about it as your own household. If you're spending 35 to 42% of your income on debt, then you're not really able to, even if you cut your household expenses down to the bone, you're still really not in a good financial position, right?
Right. And these long-term obligations, these are easily into the billions of dollars.
Oh, yeah, it's about $12 billion.
Yeah. Your reporter, Matt Helms, spoke with a few bankruptcy experts. How did they respond then?
Well, they said that they felt like an emergency manager was inevitable, and that is probably the best-case scenario at this point, because municipal bankruptcy is not a prospect to be undertaken lightly. So, I mean, you know, the consent agreement is not working. Whether or not the consent agreement could have worked is a sort of a theoretical question you could debate over coffee with a friend, but it's not working. And the city's debt continues to grow, the deficit continues to grow, and something has to be done.
And I believe, from what I understand, the ball's now in the governor's court, correct? He's going to digest the report that came out on Friday?
Correct.
Okay.
And then he's got to make some sort of decision about what to do.
How would city government and how would the people of Detroit respond to a decision by the state to appoint an emergency manager?
Well, you know, that's a really hard question. One thing that is really important to remember is that the folks who come down to Detroit City Council and say very scandalous or shocking things, it's about... I'm a regular attendee of council meetings, and I would say that's roughly the same 30 to 40 people who come down to council meetings every time to say these things. There's 700,000 people in the city, so that's 30, you know, roughly 30 people. They don't really speak for the city as a whole, though it's a very vocal, in my opinion, minority. When you look at the way Detroiters have voted in the last couple of elections, in 2009, they voted for a mayor who was not part of city government, didn't have a long career in city government, was a businessman who had never been in politics. They voted to put in a charter revision commission. They voted to change to council by districts, and they voted in five new council people. So when you look at the way Detroiters are voting, they're saying, we want things to change. And then you have a very vocal minority that's saying, we don't want things to change. Things are fine. So I think it's really important, if you're not familiar with the city, you don't live in the city, to put those loud voices into context. So how are people going to react when an emergency manager is appointed? I don't think anyone would be really happy about it. It's a pretty big deal to lose sort of local control over how your tax dollars are spent and how your city is run. But when I talk to, folks in the city, many of them want a city that works. They want their garbage picked up. They want police to come when they call. And they're getting less and less picky about how that happens.
Yeah.
I had a friend say to me recently, every day, every week when I go out and my garbage has been collected, I consider it a small victory.
Oh, my.
people want a city that works. And like I said, I think they're becoming less and less concerned about how that's achieved.
You're suggesting there's something of a silent majority in Detroit.
I'm not suggesting it. I think when you look at the poll results, you can see that there's a silent majority. Or, ballot results, for election results, you can see that there's a silent majority in Detroit that wants change.
Well, we'll wait and see what comes out of the state capitol and the governor's office here maybe this week. On a somewhat more positive note, you were involved in a Free Press editorial page project yesterday that was just great reading. I've got to commend you. It was called Encore, and it speculated on how some of the state's legendary governmental and business officials, people like ex-governors George Romney and Frank Murphy, might respond to today's challenges. Tell us about that.
Well, we started talking, this kind of came up as a joke in the office. If you could bring people back from the dead, who would they be and what would they do? And then we started talking about it, and we realized after we'd been going back and forth for about an hour that maybe this was something we should do as an editorial, because it certainly provoked a lot of conversation in our office. And we thought, there are obviously, dozens of people that anyone would love to resurrect from the dead if such a thing were possible. But we tried to very specifically think, what would we want that person to do? We came up with our list, and this is by no means like these are the only people we're talking about. That's not the case at all. We think that there's a huge conversation to be had here, and we encourage people to. I'm hosting a Twitter chat today, and people are more than welcome to join in and tweet who they would want to bring back and why. They were using the hashtag #ICDeadPeople, which is our little joke there. People at noon, from noon to one, people are more than welcome to join us on Twitter and talk about this. But we think that not only is it kind of a fun conversation to have, but it might be a good way to frame making decisions about elected leaders and what, causes you want to support. Is, instead of this sort of, oh, I like that guy, I think I'm going to vote for him, start thinking about, what does he have in common with Hazen Pingree? I really like Hazen Pingree. He was good at this, this, and this, and I'd like a mayor who has these qualities. Or, George Romney, he did some, very bipartisan things. He was the governor who signed the Public Employees Relations Act into law, which is the law that enshrined a lot of collective bargaining protections. That's such a different look from the Republican Party of 2013.
Quite.
You've got maybe this is a different way to look at our elected leaders and, the business leaders we support or the philanthropic causes we support and say, let's start being a little more rigorous and maybe a little more critical about making selections.
Well, if your Sunday Free Press is already in the recycling, go fish it out. It's good reading. It's called Encore, and Nancy Caffer had a hand in it. The Detroit Free Press's Nancy Caffer. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
A team of video storytellers from Michigan State University is wrapping up a two-month journey around the world. The crew is documenting the work of MSU researchers in countries such as China, Brazil, and Malawi as they tackle challenges ranging from malnutrition and disease to human organ trafficking. The project is called Spartans Will .360, and Current State's Kevin Lavery caught up with team leader Jim Peck by phone in Dhaka, Bangladesh, just a few days ago to learn more.
I actually came up with this crazy idea that it might be fun to try to go around the world and see some of the amazing work that Spartans are doing out there. It has grown into something that I was not expecting. I was expecting to be gone for 2 months this time of the year on the road. But it was the sort of thing where once we started pulling at the strings of these stories, more stories kept coming out. And we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the stories at MSU that are happening all around the world. And we just got our team mobilized, and amazingly, all the pieces fell into place, and now we are out here.
Your team has traveled to 4 continents. I've had a chance to look at the website and the videos and the blogs, and they are all extremely well done. I'm wondering how you have developed a strategy or a common thread for telling the stories of all the researchers you're meeting around the world.
Well, I think the common thread is that it's Spartans who are working to make the world a better place. And I almost feel like I'm on some PR campaign when I say that, but it really is true that, we're meeting men and women who are, in far-flung locations, really going after the world's toughest problems.
Dengue fever comes from mosquitoes, and it can kill you. It may not seem like a big deal to you, but here in Guangzhou, China, this is the tropics. Dengue fever is a big deal.
There can be a lot of laughter here in Magomero, Malawi, in Africa.
Welcome to the rainforest. Well, actually, this used to be the rainforest. Now it's actually downtown Campinas, Brazil.
I'm sitting here in Bangladesh, and I just literally just got back in to do this interview with you. From walking through areas that are very difficult to walk through. I mean, there are things that are hard to see. There are smells that assault your senses. People living in really difficult living conditions. And the story we're doing here is about organ trafficking. And we have met and talked with people that need money so badly, they are selling their own organs on the black market and often end up not getting the money they were promised. They have no recourse. They suffer dire consequences of surgeries and procedures that are done in unbelievable conditions. I mean, things that you would never imagine in the United States or in other parts of the world. But these are the lives these people are living in. And so we have been on the trail of very important stories.
What are MSU researchers doing to try to confront that there where you are?
Well, the researcher with whom we're working, whose name is Monir Munirazaman, has been working here doing research for quite a while. He's actually working with the Bangladesh government trying to figure out a way to end this. Officially, it doesn't exist. If you talk to people officially here, there is no problem with this. It is a different system over here, and he has been working with locals to try to stop this, to try to get to the root of it. You'll see when we release the pieces, we've done interviews with people whose identities didn't want to be revealed that are living in very, again, difficult conditions. We've talked with traffickers. We've talked with people and their families who have given organs. We've talked with people who are suffering the consequences of this. Monir calls this one of the greatest examples of exploitation in history.
In every place that you have traveled so far, what have you witnessed about the dynamic between the researchers that you are highlighting and the local people they're trying to help? Are you noticing a sense of dependence on the work of the researchers? Is there a sense of cooperation among the two groups? What's the dynamic there?
Oh, I think it's cooperation, and I think it's also a long-term commitment to trying to solve these problems. This isn't somebody that's gotten a little bit of money to go look at a problem, or somebody that's bringing aid to these villages. We see a lot of those kinds of things. My experience is that when we show up in these small villages with these researchers, they are welcomed like family. Gretchen Burbeck, that we were working with in Zambia, a very small village working with epilepsy patients, which is a kind of social death sentence for folks in parts of Africa because people don't understand it. They think it's the result of bad luck or witchcraft or something.
Everybody knows someone with epilepsy in this community. It's too common for them not to. Conditions like epilepsy that are stigmatized just get left out because nobody advocates for a disease that everyone's embarrassed that they have, right? So it just gets put in the closet.
Gretchen Burbeck lives there for months at a time. 6 months of the year, she'll live in Zambia. So these are not people that are sort of parachuting in, taking a look around, maybe dropping off some help, and then taking off again.
Are you getting a lot of feedback, particularly here in Michigan via social media, about this project?
We've gotten terrific feedback, and I think that I see it growing. I mean, we have a Facebook page that's been, highly followed. I know word of mouth has spread this. I know that, everything from my daughter's fourth grade class to the people that I know from work and other places are following our progress. And I think one of the interesting things about this is that with social media, as you know, it is something that's ongoing and will continue to have a life as people continue to participate. And these stories never end for us. So that as we travel, there will be more on the official website for the President's Report, which is report.president.msu.edu. That's kind of long, so we can maybe say that again at some point, or following us on Facebook. And if you Google it, you can find us as well. But the response has been terrific. I think that the coverage for something like this is wonderful. It's satisfying to us because we feel like we're doing a good job telling the stories. But the main thing is that people find out about these issues and they see that this university that's in their backyard or the place they went or the place they're going to is out there really honestly trying to make a difference.
Jim, when do you all return home? And once you are back in Michigan, what is the future life of this project? What happens from this point?
Well, we get back in Michigan, I think it's the 22nd or 23rd of February, so it'll be almost 2 months that we've been on the road. And then we've got a handful of Michigan stories still to tell. This is a story like all the stories with Michigan State that starts and ends in Michigan. And so we'll be closing the loop by going back to Michigan and telling another handful of stories there that are important to Michigan and the United States and the world, but they happen to be Michigan-based stories. And then for the life of this project, I know we will be adding to this the official president's report as it lives online and other iterations of that will be further brought to life and more will be put into that. And I think it's going to be interesting to see if it not only has the life that we brought to it by telling these stories. And again, you mentioned our team that's on the road. We have a very large team that's back at Olds Hall on campus that's part of the media communications team and the news team and the whole team from communications and brand strategy that's been, they have been our cheerleaders and they have been the foundations on which we stand to tell these stories. If you look at the website, you can tell this is not something that my small team on the road could put together without a tremendous amount of help from folks back there. And they have held us up very well as we've been out here looking through sometimes bleary eyes and very tired minds trying to get through these stories. And my hope is that people who are out there and see this continue to contribute their own voices to the story. We've had people write in and say, I see you're in Zambia. I did this work here. I see that you've been in China. I was there on a study abroad and had this great experience. And I think that I hope that that community continues to thrive. I'm a little scared to say that maybe we'll do something like this again for a future president's report because we're in the throes of this trip and it's been wonderful and exhausting. But I think if it's something that people like and it proves to be valuable to folks, that I think that we will hopefully be out doing some more of this stuff down the road.
Jim Peck is a familiar face on the program MSU Today, and he is the director of university photography and videography at Michigan State University. Jim, I appreciate you taking some time today from Dhaka, Bangladesh. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Labry.
It's Current State here on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. MLive's Angela Whitrock joins Current State every Monday morning to talk business and the economy and baseball, maybe, as it turns out. I've just learned you're a sports fiend, so we may have time to talk about that if there's time.
I will not argue that.
A lot's been written about Michigan's and Lansing's rebounding housing sector. And across the country as well. And you're taking an interesting angle to this and some reporting that you're doing right now. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm working on a story that will hopefully run this week about the most expensive homes in Ingham County. And I was fascinated when I found that the most expensive home on the market right now is actually in Hazlitt, and it's for sale for $3 million. And it's a palatial estate. It's very high-end. It's something you would see probably 10 years ago on Cribs on MTV. It's a very, it's just a totally tricked out home. And it's fascinating to me that there were so many homes on the market in, none in Lansing proper, but in the suburbs of Lansing for over $1 million. Typically, I think we don't think of this area as having a luxury market. We know that it's very upper middle class in some of the suburbs, but, $1 million homes on the market is just fascinating.
Are valuations, I'm under the impression valuations are clearly moving in the upward direction, and they have been.
Well, and that's one of the things that we're looking at is, we know that housing sales in the state and locally are up. We know that realtors are making higher commissions than they had been because home sale prices are up. Of course, we haven't seen that rebound in terms of property taxes, but we do know that home sales are up. What I'm most curious about is whether it's also up now in the luxury market, whether some of these homes that are, you know, on the very high end of the scale are starting to move, and if so, what that means in terms of, you know, the local economic recovery and the real estate market.
My guess is those higher valued homes are probably the first to come back. Once the market gets, housing becomes more desirable, then you see a more dramatic rise in those properties. But
I'm kind of shooting from the hip.
Shooting from the hip here. Now, for months and months, though, the smart money's been on an eventual rise in interest rates. This has already been talked about for a couple of years here now. Are we getting closer to that point, and does that mean more short-term demand for housing?
You know, I have a realtor on my running team, and she told me this weekend that interest rates are still low. They're at about 3.5% right now, which is, I mean, it's unheard of for them to have been this low for this long. And it is accelerating the timeline for a lot of buyers. But one thing that she mentioned is that it's also sort of lulling them into a bit of a false security, in that they assume that this will just be this way forever, and or that it might drop lower. And there's a lot of complicated factors that go into these interest rates, including what the Fed does, what they do with their own bond buybacks, et cetera. So how long those prices or those interest rates will last is still a matter of a lot of conjecture. But right now, like, the getting is definitely good. If you can, if you're in the market for a home, now is a great time.
I'll also point out that I tried connecting with Dart Container in Mason yesterday, and again early this morning. I saw a story yesterday indicating that Mayor Michael Bloomberg is proposing that New York City ban polystyrene cups. And curiosity got the better of me, and I started to wonder how Dart, the very successful container and cup manufacturer, could be impacted by a market that big simply banning one of their products. And I'm told that during our first segment, you heard back from somebody at Dart. What did they have to say?
I made contact with Frank Leesman. He's an attorney on staff with Dart. And he said that he thought the impact would be significant because it is the largest, New York City is the largest city in North America. They have a lot of end users and customers who they sell products to. And that also New York City is precedent setting. The things that they do tend to also influence what other cities do policy-wise. So he said it's a big concern, and that they feel there's actually a tremendous amount of misinformation around the issue. For example, one of the reasons they're thinking New York City is thinking of the ban is that, you know, they say, well, you can't recycle it. Well, that's not true. You can recycle polystyrene. You can recycle it many places. And so what Dart is really focused on is shifting that conversation away from an out-and-out ban and more toward recycling, which they feel is a, you know, more proper solution to the problem.
And polystyrene is just that's their bread and butter, right? It's
right.
the foamy stuff
right.
That with the tiny little particles.
Right, and you think about something like Dunkin' Donuts. You know, you get your coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and Dunkin' Donuts is huge on the East Coast. It comes in that polystyrene cup. Now, there are places where Dunkin' Donuts has shifted to a paper cup, but polystyrene keeps it hotter longer. So, you know, this is something that would impact a lot of businesses, you know, on the ground like Dunkin' Donuts and here in Michigan with Dart Container.
And with the baseball season 6 weeks or so off, it also crossed our minds to explore the economic impact of baseball. And I think the real clincher for me on this one was the Tigers are coming off a World Series appearance. It went pretty badly.
It did.
I mean, an awful lot of people got into it, you and me included. And how does it look for 2013, given the fact that the Tigers are coming off a championship appearance?
Well, I think one thing that we'll see will be more difficult availability for tickets. Typically, the weekend daytime games sell out fastest. So if you are in the market for a Sunday afternoon game, you should probably jump online and get your tickets now. Those are the most popular in my experience. I did find, trawling the internet last night, some interesting figures. The Anderson Economic Group estimated in 2008 that the economic impact of opening day alone in the city of Detroit was $4.54 million. That was 5 years ago. That was coming off an 07 season that wasn't that great. And now, you know, that was using average ticket prices that were lower, et cetera. And they also found that all season the impact was $117 million. So we can assume it's going to be larger this year.
Okay, a lot of excitement there. MLive's Angela Whitrock. Thank you, Angela.
Thanks, Mark.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, what's going on at the new Broad Art Museum? We've got director Michael Rush coming in. See you then.
Support for WKAR is provided by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, tablet, and online at lsj.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu